Margot Feldman is a writer, educator, and community builder committed to providing folks living with trauma opportunities to build connection. Margot is an academic who has left the institution to focus on aligning with their core values of compassion, curiosity, accountability, and emergence. Margot is also the sweet genius behind glorious Instagram account, Softcore Trauma. Welcome, Margot, to Sober Sex.
Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth. Sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more.
Hello. How are you today?
I'm good. I feel like, I don't know how witchy, astrology-y you are, but I feel like the last couple of days as the eclipse, like, passed us by were, like, some heavy ones. And, like, today I'm, like, feeling, you know, that the, like, clouds have, like, parted and there's, like, some, like, relief. So that feels really nice.
Well, and also you're covered in cats.
I mean, that's like pretty much my usual situation, if I'm being honest. Never
no
not
what.
A cat.
How did you experience the eclipse? I don't know that much about astrology, it's like full disclosure, but I'm curious as to how you experienced that phenomenon.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, eclipses are talked about as like periods where like folks are just going to feel really exhausted and like drained. Like an eclipse is supposed to like bring out the things that aren't often seen in the light. That's sort of like both like the metaphor, but also like the kind of like literal manifestation of like the sun being covered by the moon. And so, and Scorpio is just like a really broody sign that's like all about like the dark depths of the waters. So it's really just like, you know, you're probably going to have some stuff come up that you maybe thought you had processed or like were good with. And suddenly you're like, you're feeling like really triggered by it again. Yeah.
I did have therapy right before this and that tracks.
Right. I mean, whether like folks like, there we go. This is one of the things about having cats is that they'll pull out your headphones. Whether you believe in astrology or not, it's always like interesting for me to talk to folks who are just like, oh, wow, all of those things that you just said about like what's happening in the planets literally was my experience like these last couple of days. And I'm just kind of like, we're like impacted by like the weather, like we're impacted by like what is happening like on the planet. And so the idea that like the planets, which is part of our environment, are not also having some sort of impact on us, like, just, I don't know. I mean, that feels just like some like very like deeply colonialist like logic of like, you know. So
well, it's like chaos bingo where you're like, is it depression? Is it alcoholism?
Yes.
Is it patriarchy? Like, is it like literally all of the above all the time? Why am I uncomfortable right now?
Yes.
I could give you a few reasons.
Literally. I mean, there's a really amazing meme that I often see going around that's like the moon and like the moon just being exhausted because like people are just like, you know, being like, oh, it's just like the moon. It's a full moon, whatever. And like the moon just being like, y'all, it's not just me. Like, you know, there are other forces at play here, but sometimes they all just come together in a really juicy way and, you know, I was just like laid flat out for like the last couple of days watching Queen Charlotte, like the Bridgerton like spinoff on Netflix. And that was like
a Bridgerton story.
Yes. Yeah, you know.
I heard about it. And so where are you?
So right now I'm back home in Edmonton, Alberta. So I'm like north of the border. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be back in Los Angeles looking for housing and preparing to make my move there. So I feel very, very transient right now.
Well, we will return to the Los Angeles move in later in the pod. Because that's very exciting, and congratulations preemptively.
Thank you.
Not that Alberta isn't incredibly beautiful. But before we get too deep, what are your pronouns?
They, them, please.
And what is your experience of gender today?
I've been realizing it's so funny. So I identify as non-binary, and I have like a newer partner who recently used like the term tomboy to describe me, which is like a term I've like never used for myself. And I've like usually identified as like kind of like low femme. But there's like something in them like saying that like awakened something in me where I'm like, I just really feel like I am in like my tomboy femme era of like my gender right now. Like I just kind of want to be dressed like a teenage boy in the 80s with like jeans and a stripy t-shirt like I'm wearing right now, but also have my nails done and like
they're extraordinary.
Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, that's right. And how did you kind of arrive in that place? Because I think for like so many of us, it's an endless journey.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I feel like a bit of a trope in this way. Like the non-binary piece definitely came out of the pandemic of just like, you know, so many of us having our own like identity awakenings. But it's really funny because like I've known my whole life that I've been queer, like that always been attracted to people like regardless of gender, like gender never actually really made sense to me in terms of my attraction. But then I guess it took until my mid-30s for me to like catch up and be like, oh, like when people like identify, like look at you and they say like you're a woman and they use she, her pronouns, like you, like that makes you angry. Interesting. And this other like, you know, aha moment was really like I was in a non-monogamous relationship with like a cis straight man at that point in time, and everyone else that I was dating or sleeping with was trans or non-binary or fucking with gender in some way. And when I realized that at first, I was like, oh, fuck. Am I just like this like cis person like fetishizing trans folks? And then as I sat with it more, I was like, oh, no, you want to be with them because you are them. Like, there's, like, something.
It's on level vibe.
Yes, exactly. It's just like, oh, you feel more yourself, like, mm-hmm. when you are with people who really just understand that gender is, like, a construct and that we can, like, fuck with it in, like, so many ways. And that just, like, makes you feel seen. So, yeah, at that point I was like, okay, maybe I'll like play with like she and they pronouns. And anytime someone used they pronouns, it was like, that was like that feeling of like gender euphoria of just being like, oh, I love this. Okay. I need to just like get rid of the she, her and just be they, theming it up and like have never looked back.
Congratulations. I see, like, I feel kind of the effervescence when you talk about gender euphoria. That's dope. I mean, did you feel like you had to kind of go through a process of like giving yourself permission to kind of embody that? Or was it like snap, click, we good, we true?
I mean, I think that there was a lot of like trans imposter syndrome, like of, you know, like I don't feel the need to be on hormones. I don't feel the need to like have, you know, any gender affirming surgeries. Like there was no need to like change anything about like my appearance. It, you know, was much more of just like how I identify in the world. And so that definitely made me feel like at first, like, can I even claim the label trans? Which of course I know, like on a theoretical level, that I'm like, you know, being non-binary is part of the trans umbrella. Like, of course I can claim that. And so I think it was more of like seeking affirmation from other like trans folks in my life who could just say to me like, Margo, you're fucking trans. Like, and just like letting that validation just like sink in, because really who is like the imposter syndrome serving? Like, it's not actually serving me, and it's not serving like the trans community. It's like, you know, serving the cishet like powers that be for me to like doubt my own experience. So I think that was a bit more of it, but otherwise, no, I just felt like I was like slipping into, you know, the like most comfortable pajamas that I like, you know, just like, oh, this is like just who I am.
Ooh, that's beautiful. And kind of speaking of that, like speaking of kind of living in integrity, I was really impressed when it, like, I was reading your bio on your excellent website, and it seems like you're living in a way that's like aligned with values of what you mentioned were compassion, curiosity, accountability, and emergence. And I'm curious as to kind of like what those mean to you, especially emergence, because I feel like that might be the one that people are least familiar with. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about these values and what it feels like or looks like to live with them on a daily basis?
Absolutely. It's such a beautiful question. So emergence is a direct reference to Adrienne Marie Brown's book, Emergence Strategy. If you folks haven't read it, it's been like a life-changing text for me, and one that I'm like constantly referencing. And I wish I had pulled out her book originally. I could just like quote her, because I'm sure she says it like way better than I can. But emergence is like really the practice of acknowledging that, you know, the earth, the environment, like the natural world has like given us models for how to live, in which there is this sense of like intentional adaptation, which is like one of the big kind of principles of like emergence strategy. You know, emergence is about like recognizing, you know, in the scope of like our political work, that big changes happen through small everyday actions. Cause I think we can be so focused on like burning it all down, which like in my hot take is not super trauma informed, as much as I have my own moments of wanting to burn it all down. But, you know, that really like we devalue the, like, even just you and I having this conversation, like, you know, whatever is going to emerge from this conversation, you know, hopefully will be like a drop in the pond that is going to like ripple out and have an impact. And we might not know of that impact or see that impact, but like that is happening. And as someone with trauma, change is like fucking so difficult for me. And so like naming emergence as like one of like my core values for me is about like recognizing that change is constant, that change doesn't have to be traumatic. Like change in fact can be like beautiful, organic, supportive, life sustaining. And so wanting to really open myself up to a different way of like being with change that is intentional, and that moves with it rather than in resistance to it. So that's kind of like the best sort of summary I could give. Check out Adrienne's book though, because like, I'm sure again, she says it way better and the whole book is amazing.
I mean, I think it's like, you know, part of the show's namesake is sober, the sober part of sober sex. And I think that like a lot of the change being a very scary thing, but also a very necessary thing, and like kind of what a lot of recovery of any kind, but definitely within kind of sobriety related themes. Like, it, you know, it brings up shock and horror, but it's also, they talk about like the word, the language surrounding it is like an entire psychic change. It's like, yeah. It's kind of like ego annihilation and all that shit. Like, is like, oh man, that sounds so scary.
Yeah. Like, no one is sitting there being like, sign me up for ego annihilation. Like,
unless you're literally dying, you know? Yeah. And that's like, you're like, well, it's this or that. And I choose that. And it's like kind of the choosing the, I guess, the rock and the hard place, and you're like, I'll just jump off the cliff. So like, I mean, I feel like it's to kind of reframe that as something that can be in fact like gradual and beautiful. Mm-hmm. And as you say, like intentional is really exciting, because like,
well, and I think about it too, like in like a harm reduction kind of lens, like as someone who myself like has a long history of using substances as like a coping mechanism for all of the trauma that I was like living through and had lived through, you know, and I made the sort of cut like cold turkey, which like was what needed to happen for me at that moment in time. Also, I didn't know that there were other models, or I didn't have like other forms of support. But when I like think about, you know, in the world of mental health, like under the kind of like, you know, medical industrial complex, like of, you know, mental health being like a zone that's for profit. The model is very much like, just like totally cut people off from the thing that's supporting them, like abstinence only. And from like a trauma-informed perspective, like taking away someone's support tool without giving them anything else to like turn to, you know, like that is like not going to work out well, like for that person, you know. You'll just find a different tool that again, like supports your survival, but also is harming you, because that's like the, you know,
the best we can do with what we have.
Exactly. And so I think like coming back to like emergence, you know, there is more of a sense of like how can we slow things down? Like, what's like the most supportive thing we could do to support this like transition for this person, so that it doesn't have to feel like total ego death? Like, it might at some point, because like, you know, eventually as you're doing your healing, you do have this moment where you wake up one day where you're like, who the fuck am I? Like, you will have that existential crisis, because it's like you've just, you know, it's like there's like a hilarious meme that's like, you know, I realized that like my entire personality was a trauma response, and you're just like, you know, and you're like relatable. But yeah, I found like for me, slowing things down has been like really, really integral for like my own healing process.
No, thank you so much for speaking to that. I mean, and also I like, that's rad that you're sober. I did not know that when I asked you to be on the show. So even better, we'll put a pin in that and it'll add it to our list of exciting questions. So, I mean, and also I do think that, you know, it's really actually very important to kind of, to discuss that, the slowing it down part, because as much as I owe, you know, so much of my life to like, the 12 step is a modality of recovery. Like, you know, it was a bunch of like white dudes in the 1930s, like literally doing that, like creating something revolutionary, but given the time and the space with which it was created, it's like, they did not have language for that. And they were like, we found this thing that prevents people from dying of alcoholism. Like, high five, let's fucking talk about it. But it wasn't, you know, it was, there's not a lot of like trauma-informed language. Although I admire that they tried really hard.
I mean, there's some amazing like stuff that I've like from folks that I know who have been in 12-step programs and I've gotten to learn from, you know, where it's like 12-step is like actually like super transformative justice. Like, you know, like it's just like major, wild to like, you know, think about so many of like the principles that are there and being like, wow, this shit is like actually like very radical, despite, again, you know, the history and like the whiteness. And like, shout out to my friend Carolyn, who runs an amazing account called Recovery for the Revolution, because they've been like doing so much of like that work of like, how do we like decolonize recovery spaces? Because like we need recovery spaces. And, you know, for them as like a Black and Indigenous like person, like who's also trans, like going into those spaces was like really traumatic in different ways, because there was no conversation around like systemic oppression and how like that shapes like the reason we turn to substances in the first place and the way the substances get treated and like whose bodies are like being punished, you know, for substance use. So anyways,
thank you for bringing that up. Because I do think that like that part of the conversation, if we're going to make meaningful change, you know, on more than an individual level, has to be kind of talked about. So, and Recovery for the Revolution is an awesome account. Listeners, if you are interested in this kind of conversation, it's definitely worth following. And I'm curious, like kind of speaking of like living in integrity with those core values, what are some like decisions or events that have transpired in your life in an effort to kind of align with that? Like, what does that look like in a lived sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like been like a finding and refinding and losing my way and finding my way again. I think I don't have like a lot of memories from like my childhood, but I feel like somehow, somewhere, like my parents must have instilled some like core values in me around just like loving like all human beings, like and wanting to show up in the world with a lot of care. And trauma can make it like really fucking hard for us to like live our values. And so there were like, you know, years and years and years of my life where I was not treating people with love and care. Like I was acting from like a very like selfish place of just trying to get my own needs met. And after I got sober, I had to like really reckon with that. And I mean, that largely just meant feeling like a fuck ton of shame around like all of the things that I did to support my own survival, but like that were not in alignment with my values. And, you know, and that was probably like early 20s. And then I think I spent a lot of time just hiding from that shame. But like really committing myself to, you know, getting involved in like queer activism, during like my undergrad, and then like, you know, moving like into graduate school and like onwards, like becoming chronically ill and like therefore disabled, and being like, okay, like how can I do work within like that community that now I'm like a part of? And, you know, one of my core values really is like community. Like I feel like I didn't really have community growing up. Like I had like friends, you know, but like no one was really like offering like support. And that was because none of us really could, you know, like we were all kids who were like struggling. But figuring out like, oh, I actually have this like superpower of like bringing people together, and I love connecting others. And so like, what can I do out in the world to support people who often are isolated due to like marginalization to connect? And you know, that hasn't always been like easy either. I think, you know, one of my biggest struggles more recently being a human on the internet, as I call it, is that, you know, the work that you're doing is like very public in a lot of ways, but there's also so much work that you're doing that you're not making public. But like the narrative that people have of you comes from just like looking at whatever you're posting on Instagram and creating a story about like who you are. And sadly, within like the radical left, there really isn't a lot of space anymore to try something and fuck up, to be imperfect. And so that's also been like this moment of me having to like recalibrate as, you know, people like call me out or call me in, or, you know, people tell me like, oh, I don't think you should be doing this. You should be doing this. And it's like this constant practice of me having to negotiate between like, okay, am I feeling resistant to this because I'm like defensive and I'm having a trauma response, you know, or that, or is this like my white fragility coming up, or, you know, like what, or is this resistance because actually what I'm being told I like should do feels out of alignment with my values and like with what I feel like my purpose is here, like in this work. And so, you know, a tangible example of this was like, you know, right in the wake of like the Black Lives Matter uprising that happened a few years ago, there was like a call made by two like Black women whose names I'm totally blanking on right now. Apologies. But the call was for like white folks to like not post anything on like their social media that was like their own, and just like amplify melanated voices was like the call. And as I was seeing that circulate, I was like, okay, yes, like it does seem really important to like uplift, you know, these voices. I mean, always, but especially in this moment. And there's something about this that isn't sitting right with me. And I just kind of chalk that up to like my own white fragility. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to like jump on this like bandwagon. And then like the following day, like the day that they like started that call, you know, suddenly there are other like Black folks who were like, oh my gosh, now like so many more white people are showing up to my page, and I don't want to deal with all of these like white people like showing up, like trying to like extract like learning from me. And like, I've created this space for like BIPOC folks. And so criticisms of this like call started to come up. And what it made me confront was like this need that I had to like be told, you know, here's the right thing for you to do. And this is like unanimous, like everyone, you know, in this massive like community is just going to be on board with this. And I had to be like, oh, wait.
Because I think like you will be perfect and therefore liked and therefore safe.
Yes, like, yes, yes, exactly.
Yeah. And it's, I think anxiety around that and like, you know, you talked about being called out or called in. And I know you have some personal experience with that. Would you mind sharing in 1 sec? Because I saw an accountability statement on your page that I thought was really powerful. And I'm curious as to kind of how that transpired, if you're comfortable talking about it.
Yeah. So I'm just like, what's like the briefest kind of cliff notes I can give? Cause it's always like so complicated. Basically, I found out that there was like a whisper network about me. And for folks who aren't familiar with that term, it actually has its roots in like sex worker community and was like a way that like sex workers could like share online with each other, like which like Johns like to like watch out for, basically. And it is like a really important like survival tactic. And it's one that has been in use by the left outside of like the context of sex work. And so in this case, basically it came to light that there was like a group of humans kind of led by like one particular human, it seemed at this point, that was, you know, saying that I had like caused harm to folks in like the BIPOC community. And that is like a claim that I obviously want to take like really seriously. But I didn't find out any of this from like anyone contacting me directly to say like, hey, like I'm hearing this, like this, you know, it was like purely through people in that whisper network, like reaching out to people that I knew who then like told me, and we were able to get through folks in like my accountability pod, the like group of humans that, you know, I've asked like to support me if and when like there's a moment where I need to be like accountable.
Quick question. Mm-hmm. Like you'd actually set up an accountability pod prior to this happening. Like I was like very intrigued by the idea of an accountability pod, and it, so this was an existing pod that you were like, just in case I need to be accountable.
Yeah. Like, so this is,
gang. That's so awesome.
So this comes from Mia Mingus, who created, it's called like pods and pod mapping, which you can find like really super easily by Googling it on the internet, for the Bay Area Transformative Justice Collective. And you're supposed to do it like proactively. And you create like one pod for folks who will support you if you've been harmed, and another pod for folks who will support you if you've caused harm. And yeah, the idea is that like, you know, when and if like harm happens, you've got these humans who have like said like, yes, I will, you know, step into that process with you. And you can use it for like so many other things. Like, you know, you can use it for like crisis intervention. Like, who are the people that like, if you are having a mental health crisis, that you want to show up and like support you. And really, I just think it's like the most brilliant tool for figuring out like, how do we move away from police? How do we move away from like institutions, and towards actually practicing community care? So there were definitely a few people that I like called in to the pod after, as things were like happening. Because like, I think, you know, one of the things I had to sort of navigate in this situation was like, okay, one of the main claims is that I've like, you know, co-opted work by BIPOC folks. And it was like, okay, well, should my pod be all white people because I don't want to bring like and make like BIPOC folks like do that labor for me. Mm-hmm. But then also like I should be hearing from BIPOC folks because like otherwise this is just like a container of whiteness. And so what I ended up doing was like offering honorariums to BIPOC friends that I like called in so that they were like given some like financial compensation for their time, recognizing that like talking about whiteness is like not their favorite thing to be doing with other white people. So I had someone from my pod reach out to someone in the Whisper Network to ask for more information. And basically what we were given was like three different calls for accountability. And there was absolutely like no space to ask questions or be in dialogue whatsoever. It was just like, here are these three things that we believe Margot has done that are not okay. Mm-hmm. We want Margot to make like three separate Instagram posts saying I did X, Y, and Z. And then we want Margot to deplatform. So like, just like delete their Instagram.
How did that feel when you got that information? Because I can only imagine that it was really challenging.
Yeah. It was a real lesson in like regulating my nervous system. I mean, no one wants to hear that they've caused harm. Like, and, you know, as a white person, like in general, I don't want to cause harm, but like, especially I want to be like very mindful of like how I engage with like non-white folks. And so the other two claims, you know, one was that I was like using my Instagram to like trauma dump and center my white trauma. And I was like, well, this is a trauma account like about my life. And so like that, I was like, this is not trauma dumping because people are consenting to like following a page where followed, I talk about my trauma. And I'm a white person. So like, yeah, this is, you know, but then at the same time, you're telling me that I've like co-opted from BIPOC folks and I still don't understand what that actually means. Like, was I like, did I, you know, like present someone's ideas as my own? Did I like misquote? Like what? Like there was no further information given on that. And then the third was that like I shouldn't have taught a webinar on parts work, which was like very much framed as like a peer support. Like this is like a peer-to-peer. I'm not someone who was like trained in parts work. This is like my own work and my research that I've like done and I'm like sharing with you. And their call there was that like, I should not have taught that because I was lacking the qualifications to do that. And I was just like, well, here we just have like a fundamental disagreement on the importance of like peer-to-peer work. And what was like so fascinating to me about that too was like, theoretically, my guess would have been that, you know, they would actually be for peer-to-peer work because, you know, the reality is like Black, Indigenous, and people of color are like historically kept out of universities and like, you know, like the certifying Academy. Bodies, yeah, that are like going to give you these credentials. And these are communities who have known and been practicing like trauma healing outside of, you know, being trained therapists or whatever for like centuries. And so the math just like kind of wasn't mathing to me, where I was just like, this doesn't feel in alignment with what I would assume your values would be. So really we just kind of like bracketed those two, and like the focus was like, okay, how, like, if we're not going to be told more about like what I've done in terms of like co-opting from BIPOC creators, then the conversation really became, how can I, as a white person with this like big platform, and at the time I had about 20,000 followers, like, how can I better use my platform to be uplifting and, you know, BIPOC folks? And given that so much of the work that I do is informed by Black, Indigenous, and people of color, how can I like balance the fact that like obviously I am like earning my living not just off of that work, but like that work is part of like my citational practice. So how can I balance that? And so, you know, that's when I started to just be like, okay, all of like my webinars are just going to be free for BIPOC folks. That is like a way that I can like try to like redistribute some of that like wealth. Mm-hmm. And of course, none of these were the things that they wanted. And so, you know, after I'd written the accountability statement, you know, walking through like, here's how I understand what has happened, here are the steps that I've taken towards accountability, here are the receipts of how I've been like blocked, like from getting to be in dialogue, even not just like me in particular, because maybe I'm just like literally not a safe enough person, and that is cool, and I like accept that. But even just like, you know, even like BIPOC folks in my pod would reach out for more information and would be like shut down. So it was just like, to me, it was really sad, like, because I was just like, this actually could be an opportunity where like actual transformation could happen. And me deplatforming actually isn't making that transformation happen. It's like, I could still continue to do the work that I do through my newsletter, like, you know, or figure out other means for doing that. Still causing the same harm because I haven't been given enough information to help me stop doing that harm. Mm-hmm. And so it's just like a bummer to me that like, that there could have actually been like really supportive, healing, productive like dialogue, and that there just like was not space given for that in any way, like, you know, that could have done something more.
Yeah, create progress. But I mean, yeah, it's interesting because I do think it sounds, I'm very moved because I feel like your commitment to like what I would call an amends process was really, mm-hmm, like really rooted in truly wanting to like transform in a positive way. And it sounds like, mm-hmm, you made a lot of like concrete efforts to do so. But I also think that like, you know, if we're going to talk about integrity, like as a value, that not just kind of like being like, okay, whatever you want, is also an impressive, yeah, and important kind of part of the story. Because I do think that like in a lot of cases, if like so much, anything in terms of like both causing harm and being called out, especially like creates such a kind of shame vacuum that it's easy to kind of either like roll over or like disappear or want to deeply to do one of those things. Mm-hmm. So the fact that you were able to kind of have already like a network of accountability and support was really cool. And I think, you know, again, like most of my kind of core people and systems of support come from 12 step, but it's often those are kind of a one-on-one relationship with like a sponsee and a sponsor when you need support going into an amend.
Sure.
And so this idea of having kind of a little bit more like, I don't know, dynamic systems set up is really, really cool. Because like, I mean, we're all fucking up all the time.
And we're going to continue to fuck up because humans, like, there is like no world in which, like, even when I imagine like the beautiful queer utopia, like, I like harm is going to happen there too, because humans are imperfect. Like we will have a night where like we don't get enough sleep and we wake up cranky and we're like short with like our partner who just made us like a coffee and like, you know, and that's hurtful. Like, you know, we, you know, one of like the sort of like mic drop, like therapy moments for me was my therapist saying, you know, that secure attachment isn't the absence of rupture, but it's the presence of repair after rupture has occurred. And that to me has been something. Yeah. 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 Just take a second for that little nugget. and that was something I really like had to like anchor onto, because of course so much shame. Oh my God, so much shame came up in that process. Like my biggest fear is that secretly I'm a horrible person and one day everyone is going to find out and abandon me. And I'm also someone who has like been bullied. I am someone who like, you know, had my friends abandon me right at the start of high school. And like, you know, like, so it was both this like moment of being like, oh my God, my worst fear has come true. And also all of this like stuff from the past being like called up to like get processed at the same time. And, you know, I think like all of my like fieriness in me that I like repressed for so long, you know, that I've been working to create more and more space for, which is like, this isn't the answer. Like, also this is just, this isn't transformative justice. Like this is not like so many steps were skipped between like harm happening and call out and then like call for cancellation that like, you know, you can use the language of accountability and transformative justice all you want, but like, this isn't that. And so I really had to like root into that. And, you know, that's like a space where like people that were in my pod who were all people that I knew shared those values, like could anchor me in. Because
and kind of a common acknowledge process also.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Just like mirror that back to me in those moments, you know, and it's like, you know, for every, like, I'm sure that people have been harmed by me. Like, I have never questioned that that is like a possibility in the world. Like,
and I mean, again, like you're doing like trauma work. Like,
yes. Yeah. It's hard. Totally. And like people who are certified like trauma therapists are also causing harm. Like there is no like bulletproof way to be like, you're a human who works with people with trauma and you're not causing any harm. Like that's, so, you know, again, like my, obviously I want to take all of the steps I can to try to like mitigate harm that I cause. And, you know, what I really hope for is like, and I know this is hard because I have a large platform and that like gives me a lot of power and like, therefore like the power imbalance is real. But I really do hope that like folks could, you know, come to me when they've experienced harm so that I can be accountable for it and we can talk about it. But I think the other piece that this brings up too, that's really tricky and slippery and hard to talk about in our moment right now, is that like there's been so much like overuse of the term harm, and like conflation of harm with abuse. Because even like, you know, more recently, as there is an account that's still out there very committed to having me not exist, you know, like that's the language that they're using. Like Margot Feldman is an abuser. And I'm just like,
like, we have a meme account.
Yeah, totally. I'm like, and you need relationship, like in some way to like have a pattern of abuse or like to have perpetuated abuse. And so I'm just like, but yeah, these terms, you know, they're ones that we need to take seriously. And also, sadly, are really being emptied out of their meaning through their overuse and making it really challenging and creating a culture of fear where, you know, like the last time, you know, there was like two rounds basically of this call out that happened. And in the last round, I lost like 20,000 followers, which like, it's a lot of people. Like, and I know that I have like a much larger following now. So it's like a drop in the bucket, but like, you know, that's like 20,000 people that were like, saw that and they were like, all right, like unfollow, you know, because really then if you are still engaging with my work, then you're seen as being guilty by association and you're seen as like being an apologist. And that, you know, is really like an unnuanced way to think about it, especially as we're talking about just a group of fucking strangers on the internet. Yeah. Like,
it's a big thing. I mean, I do think that that's it too. It's like, if you don't have a personal relationship to kind of base these claims on, or even to kind of fall back on when you're like, I guess like an unfollow isn't like a huge deal in someone's day or life or whatever. But at the same time, it's like, I think there is so much kind of, as you say, like guilty by association or the fear of being so.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to kind of like, cause I, as you were saying, like the ability to like regulate your own nervous system surrounding this stuff is huge. Cause I know that like, it's the feeling of somebody being like, you did something that you totally didn't intend on doing. And it totally like fucked me up. It's like really scary, you know, like, damn, I can feel like the cortisol surge as I talk about it, like by proxy. And I'm really impressed by kind of like, I don't know, the way that it seems like you really stayed grounded in like intentionality and like the facts, and not to say like, fuck you, I didn't cause harm, but like,
yeah, no,
be like, if you want to talk about it, awesome, like we have a process, let's do it. And then it's an invitation to engage as opposed to the kind of I don't know, some kind of like fight back or disappear.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way that I could say that like I haven't caused harm. Like, I don't know, like I haven't seen the receipts, like I don't know. That could be very, very real and valid. So,
the dog is wagging her tail in her sleep. It's just like, it's my favorite thing she does. I'm sorry. I'm just like looking ecstatic while you're like, I have the receipts. I'm just like, the dog. apologies.
No worries.
She's ready. her dream life is incredible.
So pure.
She's like, I don't have social media.
Oh my gosh, so fucking lucky. It's like, can I come back as like a well-loved dog or cat in my next life, please? Like,
I second that notion. So, you know, to kind of take a sharp pivot, now about sex. I'm curious, like one of the anchor questions for the show, which is always awkward to bring up, is what were the first messages you received around sex or sexuality when you were growing up?
Yeah, it's so funny because it's like, you know, my memory from like childhood is like so vague because LOL trauma, but like, you know, so I can't, there's no like, you know, like I saw this commercial or like it was like this like book. But like very early on, I just like understood that like as like an AFAB person, like assigned female at birth, like that my body was there to like please men and to be pleasing for boys or men or whatever. And I think like that definitely really like hit me, you know, in like, so we didn't have like junior high where I grew up. So it was like, you know, grade, still in elementary school, like grade six, grade seven, grade eight, as like, you know, the hormones are starting to like surge and, you know, and I'd have all these crushes on boys and I was never like one of like the popular kids. I wasn't like super unpopular, but I was sort of like in the middle, like, you know, and these boys would like hang out with me in like in private, like we would have these like secret like rendezvous like at night, but then like would pretend like I didn't exist like the next day at school. And I learned that because I wasn't like seen as like one of like the popular girls, my like currency was my sexuality. And I've been like a very sexual person from like a very young age. And so, you know, it like, you know, was like, okay, like I'll make out with these boys. I'll like, you know, like we'll have some like second base, maybe even third base like action. And so, yeah, in that way, I learned like that if I wanted attention, which to me was like love, you know, conflated those, it's like I had to like use my sexuality in order to get that need met.
I totally hear that. And I wonder when drugs and alcohol entered the picture, if that was like around the same time.
It sure was. I'll just give like a trigger warning for folks like around rape, because that is like part of the picture. So feel free to do what you need to do. But yeah, I mean, I definitely, you know, probably around like the age of like 13, started hanging out with like some older boys, like, you know, I guess probably actually around the time that I was just turning 14. So right before starting high school, cause I'm a Cancer, so I'm a little summer baby. And I would go down to this like park, like by my house where, you know, boys who were like 16, 17 hung out and they would like get me high. They would like, they were smoking weed. So then, you know, that would be the case. And then like, yeah, one night one of them like brought me into the like woods, and all I like remember is just like feeling this like really sharp pain. And, you know, this person was like inside of me, and I'm really grateful that like at that moment I could be like, hey, I want to stop this. And like, he listened, but it would take me like so many years before I was like, oh, that wasn't consensual because you were so inebriated, and like in fact like these boys had like gotten you high. And at that point it was like, well, then I just started getting high all the time, and like drugs really became this way to like bury that experience, but also all of this like other trauma that, you know, was happening in my home that like, you know, really started with like my mom's death a few years before that. It escalated pretty quickly. So by the time I was like going on 15, you know, I was doing ecstasy. That's what we still called it at the time. I like have these like hilarious moments where I'm watching like television and the kids are doing drugs now and using all these different names, and I feel like old.
You're like, who's she?
I was like, who's Molly? So yeah, I would say that like I was like high like every single day of my life from like 14 probably to like 22, 23. I stopped using harder substances around the age of 18 because I nearly OD'd. And that was like a really massive like wake up call for me, where I was just like, I don't want to die. And I had already had some friends of mine who also used with me kind of have this like intervention moment with me, because they were just like, Margo, like, we're like worried about you. Like, you know, because it was no longer just like doing harder stuff on the weekend. It was like, oh, maybe I'll just like do a little something during the week and go walk around the mall and like, you know. And then I continued smoking weed for like another couple of years until like, yeah, I think around like 22 is when I stopped with that.
What made you decide to stop then?
Weirdly, my body was having like a really intense reaction to it. I was like getting high and feeling so ill. Like I just like lost my appetite. Like I felt nauseous all the time. And I like wonder if that was just like my body's way of trying to be like, well, we're done. We're done with this. We like, yeah, we just don't want you to be putting this stuff in your body anymore. So, and I had quit smoking by that point as well. So it was sort of like the last kind of like piece to let go of.
And you mentioned a little earlier, and also like, thank you for your vulnerability and sharing all that stuff. And I'm sorry that happened. And I wonder kind of how you, like how it unfolded from there. Like one, how did you stop smoking weed? Mm-hmm. You said like cold turkey. And then also like, how did your kind of, yeah, like your healing process transpire?
Yeah. I mean, it definitely was like very like cold turkey. It's like largely how I've had to do everything. It's like my, again, like I wonder if like there are other models or like I had the language for harm reduction that might've been an option, but it was, yeah, very clear to me that my body was like, nope, we just don't want this. And yeah, then, so let's think, that's like early 20s. So the next relationship that I was in was with someone who was like very like emotionally abusive. And when that relationship ended, I started therapy, for the first time. I mean, I had one foray into therapy when I was 18. Shout out to that therapist who I saw for 2 sessions. But like, yeah,
I'm sure they're listening. Like,
she, it's so funny because like, you know, I always think of her when I talk about like how hard it was for me to like learn that it was okay to feel anger, because in like our first or second session, she had like asked me if I was angry and I was like, anger is a wasted emotion, because like anger in my household was violent. And so like, I learned that like,
not allowed.
Not allowed.
Not for you anyway.
Not for me. And then, you know, fast forward to starting somatic therapy 5 years ago or so, which was like all about like recognizing that like my inability to feel anger, feel my fight response was like directly correlated to my chronic pain. And I was just like, whoa, okay, cool. Guess I have to learn to feel anger now. So that was like a couple years worth of really intense work.
Do you feel like it's been helpful
in terms of
managing chronic pain? Like,
literally.
Is that real? Is it really like unlocked?
Yeah, I mean, when I started somatic therapy, so like, you know, to sort of bridge the gap. So there was like, you know, my first like therapist that I saw for more than like 2 sessions. And that was just through my university. So I only had a certain number of sessions with him. And then I had a series of different therapists over the years that I worked with for whatever period of time it felt like was like, okay, we've done the work we're supposed to do together. And then I find like a different therapist. But all of that like led up to, I guess 2017 when something was like happening with my body that was not familiar to me. Like, you know, panic attacks, anxiety, like those things were like very familiar. But like later what I recognized was that I was just like dissociative. And that's what was happening. And alongside that, I was just like hit by such intense chronic pain, like just barely could like leave my couch to like make dinner, would like lose my breath walking to the bathroom. Like it was like pretty insane. Like, you know, like if I needed to run out of my house because there was a fire, like I could have, but otherwise it was like pretty debilitating. And so I knew I needed to start, I knew that there was something happening with my body. And I was like, I need to see someone who works with the body. And got connected to the therapist who I've now been with for over 5 years. But yeah, one of the things, you know, that I was already learning prior to starting to see her, because like a good little academic, I was like, okay, something's going on with me. Let me like research, like to think about like, you know, the connections between trauma and like chronic pain. And I discovered like Gabor Mate's work and discovered like Bessel van der Kolk's When the Body Keeps the Score, or The Body Keeps the Score, which like
there's a non-drinking game. Like there's a water shots game on Sober Six for how many times we can bring up Bessel van der Kolk.
Oh my gosh.
So, classic Bessel. Oh, we love.
Yeah. And I mean, sadly, I've heard that he's like not a great dude, and like there's like some like, yeah, especially around like women. So I really try to like plug When the Body Says No by Gabor Mate. Yeah, I know. It's a bummer.
So deeply disappointed. God damn it, Bessel.
I know. You're just like waiting. You're like, all right.
Who next?
Who's next? Who's
fire from my heroes list?
Like, I know. I just like keep like holding strong that like Jeff Goldblum will like continue to not become someone on that list. Cause I
just crossed, baby.
I just love Jurassic Park too much for that to happen.
But apologies for interrupting. So you were doing this research, and is that kind of what led you into your path towards becoming a trauma educator?
Yeah. So it's really fucking funny how, I mean, I was writing this whole dissertation that was about trauma. I've always been interested in like trauma theory. Like I, you know, my undergraduate work, like I did an undergraduate thesis using psychoanalysis. Like I have all always...
like, what were you supposed to be studying?
Yeah. Well, it's like, what, so, you know, English literature. So it's like,
perfect.
But I had actually started my BA as a crim and psych double major, cause I was like, wanted to be a criminal psychologist. I've always been like really interested in like how our brain can like, how we can suspend ethics, basically. Like how do people cause like egregious harm? Like what is happening in their brain that allows them to do that? And just like hated the way that you have to learn in those modalities. Like I am not a multiple choice test human. My brain just like literally doesn't work that way.
And you're like, also cops.
Yes. Also police, turns out, don't love them. So I'd actually had flunked out of university. And when I came back the following year, I just started to take some like English lit and philosophy classes, cause that's what I really liked in high school. So I've always been interested in story. Like that has also been like, you know, just like a key theme. Like what are the stories that we tell? How do stories help us feel less alone in the world? So it made sense that eventually I was like, okay, I'm going to, you know, do this English lit PhD. But all along the way, I'm like doing this reading about trauma, thinking that it's totally unrelated to me. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, just a special interest.
Yeah, just super stoked about the notion and concepts surrounding trauma.
Yeah, just like, wow, this is fascinating to me. And I really think that was like, actually my like brain's really smart way of being like, okay, we want you to do this healing, but like, we need to like introduce you to these concepts in this way where there's still some distance. Mm. And like,
side door.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, you know, eventually just being like, oh, right. Like this whole PhD dissertation that I'm writing that like, you know, eventually became much more personal. It was no longer just about trauma, but after I got sick, it became about sickness, and, you know, chronic illness and trauma and intimacy. But all of it was like deeply personal. LOL, like, you know, and academia does a really great job of like making you feel like you need to separate like the personal from like the academic. And so as soon as I like realized that, I was like, oh, I'm actually just writing about me. Like this is,
it's really research backed. So
yes, exactly. It's like, here's all the sources that tell you that there's a link between chronic illness and chronic pain and trauma. Here you go. Not just me standing up here on a soapbox. So I think things started to unfold. Like, I had this Instagram account originally for a blog that I had that was about like feminism, feelings, and fashion. And I stopped doing that blog to focus on doing other writing. And so then I just started sharing little snippets of my writing on Instagram, and people liked that. So that was cool. And then I don't know, at some point I guess I just recognized that I have an ability to translate theory into like accessible language for people. And I've always been passionate about education. I did a PhD because I wanted to be like a university professor, and so I was like, oh, cool. I love the idea of like making all of the shit that I get to learn through like my academic work, like accessible for folks. So then it became this like platform where I started to do this like trauma education. But there was no like plan for that whatsoever. It was just kind of like, and if you scroll back like deep enough on my Instagram, it's like you can find like the post from when I had the blog, and you can see like the little moments of me sharing writing.
The through line.
Like, yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think through all of it has been this like, how do we heal and how do we foster the kinds of relationships that we want to be in that like are supportive and loving and expansive, because that's always been something I've like yearned for and didn't get to experience growing up, and really didn't get to experience even until like friendships in like my 20s.
I mean, but it seems like, I mean, that you talked earlier about your superpower being kind of gathering folks together and creating community, that like that knowing that about yourself has allowed you to kind of create that, you know, with intentionality on the internet with softcore trauma. Like, that it's happening.
Nice reflection. Yeah. And I mean, to all the haters out there who say like community doesn't exist, like on social media, I'm just like, I don't know where you all are hanging out, but I mean, it's like really beautiful to me to even just see like in the comments to like post, like someone will post something that they're like struggling with. It's in relation to like the memes that I made. And then like random humans are just like commenting and like saying affirmative things to them. And, you know, it's like, because I think the reality is like people feel really alone with like what they're like living with. They might not have people in their like immediate circle who understand trauma, who are like doing the same kind of like work that they're like doing. And so definitely like I hope that like my Instagram can be a place for that. And like one of the things that I do is like run a peer support group, usually like once or twice a year, where we meet for like 8 weeks, and it's a much smaller like cohort of humans. And like really the reason I started doing that is because I'm like, I want to connect you all. I want you to be in space with like other humans who are doing this work, that like even if you live on opposite ends of like the country, like you have this like person that after this group has ended, hopefully, you know, you are staying in connection with, and like that bond can be a support while you work on cultivating that in your IRL life.
It's really, really beautiful. And I mean, do you feel like how did your relationships, how did your kind of romantic life, how did your own ability to form community kind of shift as you were doing this work? Like, what changed?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it was just like fucking luck. I don't know. Like, my two best friends are like the most incredible humans ever. And like, you know, when I met like both of them, hilariously, like they were both like very super Christian, and I was absolutely not like religious in any way. And I was like, you know, talking about being queer and like, you know, and those two, like they didn't know each other. Like this was like separate from that. But somehow we like became like really close friends, and both of them you know, within however number of years, like both realized that they were both super gay. And so that was like also like beautiful and amazing to like, yeah. So, you know, part of it like feels like, I don't know, like just like a gift from the universe that I got to connect with these two humans who were also just so committed to growth and committed to living their values and committed to healing. And, you know, like we've been friends now for like over 15 years. And through them, like I have healed, I've done more healing in those friendships than I definitely have in like romantic relationships. Like, and I think so much of the time, you know, when we talk about like healing attachment wounding, it's like talked about as like something that you heal with like a romantic partner, but it's like, there was no way I could have done that without first having built that base with them, you know, and getting to practice boundaries with them, getting to, you know, like call my best friend while like before I was like medicated for anxiety. And like, you know, I was like, I heard a noise in my apartment and I know that someone hasn't broken in, but like everything in my body is saying that someone has. And like, her getting on her bike and biking over to my place so that the two of us at like total of like 5'2", like probably weighing like 120 pounds, like each, like, you know, could like walk through my house and open up all the doors to be like, okay, there's like no one there, you know? So yeah, shout out to Natalie and Varya for like forever changing my life. And then through them, I started to like practice trying those same skills in my romantic relationships. And it was utterly terrifying. And, you know, but it got easier over time. And, you know, a lot of healing got to then happen in romantic relationships as well. So, yeah, it's like, I don't know. Like, I know that, like, I have done a lot of work to cultivate those relationships. And also it just feels like a gift that I got to receive of like these two humans.
I love this conversation. I think we should have more like best friends shout outs.
Yes.
And like, yeah. And like platonic friendship as like, you know, one of the highest forms of love.
100.
My heart.
Yeah.
So you're headed into an MFA at the very impressive CalArts after departing from academia, hence your move back to California. We do a full circle ride on here. On and I'm pleased with myself for tying this up so beautifully. So what are you excited about or what do you want to work on within that program?
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to fucking live in California. That's like definitely. Oh my gosh. And I mean, like, I'm an immunocompromised person, like living in Canada, like living in like northern Alberta. So like, and I live alone. So like winters are like big bummers. Like I'm like alone a lot of the time. So, you know, even just like, yeah, being able to sit outside in a cafe during the winter and like be able to meet up with like friends is going to be rad. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because like I actually had no more plans of doing school, but I have known for a while that that LA is like the next place for me to be. And so the only ways I could like make that happen were to get married, get a job, or go to school. So
there we are.
I was like, all right, well, I've like, you know, finished the manuscript for my first book. I'm like working with an agent on getting that out. I've got the next book that I want to work on. So why don't I apply to do an MFA? And then I can like use my time in that program to work on this next book and just get to be in community with other writers, which like to me is like so exciting and so nourishing. So the next book is called Queer Wounds, Reckonings on Relationality and Harm. And it is, love your facial expression there.
Look like a Cupid doll.
And yeah, it's really about the ways in which
aunties. I know you're listening. check the fuck out when it's finally in the world.
Yeah. So it's about like the ways in which queer folks in particular harm each other in our relationships, and like what the sort of central thesis is that, like, you know, and this isn't just particular to queer folks, but I think like folks in social justice world, like who aren't queer, will probably also see themselves in this, but really looking at the ways in which we have taken the tools that are supposed to heal us and weaponize them against each other. Mm-hmm. And so like, you know, looking at the ways in which like therapy language, you know, and like boundaries and attachment styles, like the ways that like we are like using, you know, particular like diagnoses to dispose of each other, or we're using boundaries as a way to like avoid accountability. You know, also looking at the ways in which like queers really romanticize vulnerability. But then as soon as like you're actually having to do the work of vulnerability in a relationship, like you are just like piecing the fuck out of there because it's like so terrifying. So those are some of the like through lines for that project.
That sounds incredible. And congratulations on heading to LA.
Thank you.
And I wonder where you are growing either creatively or professionally today. Creatively or professionally. I meant personally or creatively or professionally, if you so choose that,
I mean,
that category.
They all kind of overlap. Like I often have this like hard time being like, am I reading this book for pleasure or am I reading it for work? Like it probably could be both.
It's a good life.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that's like feeling really good for me is that I've been doing more visual art stuff recently. I'm like gonna be having a Kickstarter in July for like a deck of cards that I've like made that are like, I'm calling them like anchor cards. So cards that people can pull similar to like an Oracle deck or something, but like each one is like some sort of tool to support like healing or like self-regulation. And so they're all made with like collage images that I've like made. And so
keeping in the car.
So I'm going to like literally after this call, I'm going to scan all of those in and like send them off to the human who is going to do their work with them so they can be sent off to the printers. And I just like, so it's really hard for me to make time for like visual art stuff because I want to be writing and I'm also often teaching and like there's like other stuff I want to be doing in the world. So I'm feeling really nourished by that. And then like personal growth wise, it's like figuring the fuck out how I'm going to get to LA and like navigating navigating all of the bureaucracy of like, you know, and barriers of like getting there and getting a student loan and like, and it's feeling like wild to like witness myself like move through that, feeling so much more grounded than I have in the past because I don't love uncertainty. And I don't love my fate being in the hands of banks and government and other institutions. But overall, I'm just like recognizing like, okay, I'm feeling pretty chill about this like most days. And so that feels just like exciting for me to notice in my own growth.
That's very exciting. I concur. And before we let you go, we're gonna end the episode with a thrilling lightning round. Don't think too hard, just to end on kind of a fluffy note.
Okay.
What's your favorite snack?
Chips.
What kind?
Dill pickle.
Oh, a Canadian delicacy.
Oh yeah.
I live in France, honey. Dill pickle chips. But that sounds fantastic. The Canadians have all the luck. And all the winter, alas. What is a TV show, book, or movie that you've recently consumed and loved?
Succession.
Fantastic. I mean, We could have a spinoff episode about Succession. What? So I usually write down the lightning round questions. I'm just freewheeling. What turns you on? And it can be creatively or intellectually or like physically charged up or as you wish to take that question.
People who are committed to their own growth.
Hell yeah.
Turns me on in all the ways.
Awesome. What is a way that you can psych yourself up or like upregulate if you're feeling a little bit low and unmotivated?
I mean, it's cheesy, but I'll often do like the like power pose of like
akimbo.
Planting your arms starfish. Up, like yeah, starfish, like in the air. I think it's like called like the Superman pose or something. Usually with like a song that gets me like really pumped up, just like on. Also, often red lipstick will also help.
But they can be done simultaneously.
Yes, all of them together.
And what? How do you downregulate and kind of self-soothe if you're feeling anxious and kind of wound up?
I love to place both of my hands over my heart and close my eyes and just focus on my breath and the feeling of my hands just over my chest. Nothing soothes me more.
Awesome. Perfect. And finally, what do you love?
Oh, gosh, everything. I love people. I love my cats. I love water, drinking it, being in it. I love this new stripy t-shirt that I got from Uniqlo that I've been wearing like basically every day, like a uniform.
It's really good. It's like, it's very on brand with like the tomboy femme vibe you're carrying into the world.
Feel very seen in it. And I love being able to get to have conversations with total strangers from the internet. And it's like, hey. I'm a fave.
What a treat. Thank you so much, Margo. It was a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sober sex, you'll never get bored. Sober sex, all of this and more. Sober sex, we're never ever bored. Creativity, authenticity, body autonomy, mental health, sexuality, gender identity, recovery, got a spiritual growth. Sober.